In 1881, Edouard Beaupré was born in Willow Bunch, Saskatchewan. Other than the fact that he had 19 brothers and sisters, he was a fairly typical child. He started going to school at age 7 and was, by all means, average. But then he started to grow. Within 2 years, he was 6 feet tall, pretty big for a 9-year-old. And by 12, he was 6'6". By 17, he was 7'3". He started to tour as a strongman, wrestler, and a circus sideshow. He would bend iron bars with his hands and pick up a 600-pound horse right on his shoulders. And he was still growing. He signed with Barnum and Bailey Circus to be part of an exhibition at the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. At this point, he was 8'3", and he weighed 375 pounds. Sadly, while in St. Louis, he died suddenly from a pulmonary hemorrhage at the age of 23. He is the 5th tallest person in recorded history. If you've been on social media lately, you may be aware of another very tall Canadian. Olivier Rioux, from just outside Montreal, grew to be 7'5" by the time he was 15 years old. There are some great videos of him playing basketball against kids his own age, and it looks, well, a bit unfair. Currently, Rioux is 7'9", taller than any NBA player in history. The 18-year-old has just started his collegiate basketball career at the University of Florida. He's a redshirt freshman, which means he'll train with the team, but won't see any playing time this year so he can save his eligibility for future seasons. He's in the Guinness Book of Records as the tallest teenager in the world. This week on See Thee Rise, we have another very tall man. He's not quite as tall as Edouard Beaupré or Olivier Rioux, but at 7'2", Greg Stewart is still a little taller than average. And although he had a great university career as a basketball player, it's his 2 Paralympic gold medals in shot put that put him on the national stage. Aside from being a big person and a tremendous athlete, he's also a motivational speaker who frequently focuses on mental health and emotional awareness. I had a great talk with Greg, so let's get to it. Joining me today is a 2-time Paralympic gold medalist. He's also an author. He's also a motivational speaker. I'm really excited to talk to you today. Greg Stewart, thank you for joining us on See Thee Rise.
Beautiful. Thank you for having me. I'm pretty pumped.
So I'm going to start with a weird question. For people who don't know you, can you just give me a little description of your body?
A description of my body. Okay, so if you were to see me walking down the street, I would be that person that you can't keep your eyes off of. Not because of the way I, you know, not my ridiculously good-looking looks, nothing that, more so the fact that I'm going to be the biggest person you have ever seen walking down that street. And to fill that in a little bit more, I am a 7'2" tall man. Weighing in at about 360 pounds. So I'm a very, very large person. And 9 times out of 10, when I'm walking down the street, 98% of the people are going to look at me while I'm walking down that street.
So that's where I was kind of going with that. But then you've also got the arm. Tell us a little bit about...
So there's that too, right? Not only am I tall, yeah. But I'm also missing my left arm below the elbow. I was born that way. But the reason why I bring up the height right away is because people don't typically recognize my arm. They only see my height. And sometimes it takes a little while of a, more of a conversation to be had. My goodness, I didn't even realize you had one arm.
Yeah, so basically I've read somewhere you say that the height is actually the disability, not the arm.
100%. 100%. To me, a disability is something that affects you on a daily basis, makes it more challenging for your routines and whatnot. And my height impacts me far more than my arm does. One big reason, because I was born this way. I don't know any different, but I wasn't 7'2" when I was born, thank goodness. But I, gradually got taller and taller and taller, and it honestly affects everything that I do.
How old were you, or was there a moment where there was this massive spurt that you maybe weren't expecting and you went from being kind of tall to really tall?
Yeah, I remember sitting down and having a conversation at dinner time with my family, and I think I might have been like 10, 9 or 10 and we were like, oh, well, you know, based on how you're growing and this and that, you might be quite tall. And when I was 14, I was 6'8". So 6'8", 14-year-old, 170 pounds, skinny little dude. And then, yeah, I grew another 8 inches.
Wow. I'm 6'2", and a lot of people think I'm tall. But you got a foot on me, so I can't imagine what that's like. Sticking with the growing up bit, I've read that you've played a lot of able-bodied sports and competed at a fairly high level, especially in basketball at the university level. Talk about what that's like for you, and what that experience was like.
Absolutely. So I think one thing that's really important to mention, us as human beings and whatnot, society, we all want to feel that sense of either fitting in or having a sense of belonging. And I know it's really, really multiplied in the feelings wise for people with a disability, because we already see ourselves as different, or at least society sees us as different. And so why I bring that up is, all of a sudden I'm a 14-year-old kid, I'm 6'8", I'm tall. And all of a sudden I start hearing more of these conversations of, hey, you should do this, you should do that. Right. And when people are telling me I should be doing something, I'm gravitating to the fact that, hey, I might start to feel like I belong. I'm starting to feel like I fit in. So I started to take up the sport of basketball and volleyball. I played 12 years on our national disabled volleyball team. And I played 5 years of university basketball at Thompson Rivers University on the able-bodied side. I had a really great career. I finished my last 2 years as a Canada West Defensive Player of the Year, as well as CIS, or U Sport Now, Defensive Player of the Year in basketball. You know, averaged 15 points, 13 rebounds. So, like, I had a really good career at university basketball. Well, one thing about it was that I never felt a sense of fulfillment while I was doing it. And what I came to learn further on down that road is I didn't feel a sense of fulfillment because I was playing it because people said that I should do it. And I was hoping that I was going to feel a sense of belonging, but I never did. And so for majority of my basketball career, I was trying to find the sense of fulfillment and belonging, but never actually connected and never felt that sense of connection to it, even though I was still quite successful at it.
Was that something that you recognized at the time, or was that something you kind of figured out in retrospect?
Yeah, so definitely figured it out further on in my life. The other part to it, especially in sports, is we attach our identity to that sport. So I'm Greg the basketball player, I'm the Greg the shot putter. And because of that, when that is over, we now lose that sense of identity. Who are we? Because we have all of the attention on that specific thing, and we're not actually looking at ourselves and as us as a whole. And then when that's removed, it's just like, holy cow, like what's going on here? So yeah, it was definitely retrospect. It was actually about, you know, 3 or 4 years after university where I finally recognized, oh, wow, I'm Greg Stewart. I'm disabled. This is amazing. Let's explore this side of things.
Were you competing in seated volleyball at the same time, or did that come later?
Yeah, so I played standing disabled volleyball for about 7 to 8 years. And then I did another 4 to 5 years in seated. Seated was kind of during my basketball career as well, and then after my career for a bit. So I kind of did dual sports for about 3 years there, 4 years. And then after I finished playing basketball, I just continued playing seated. And seated, I definitely enjoyed a little bit more.
Does the height advantage translate on seated volleyball?
Yeah,
is it reach?
It does. Yeah. So like for anyone that doesn't know what seated volleyball is, it's literally volleyball sitting on the ground. The court's a lot smaller. The net's about 4 feet off the ground. And it's still 6-on-6. And it is a Paralympic sport. And yeah, I played that for, yeah, like I said, that was 3 to 4 years. But my height did still translate. Even though I wasn't standing, I could still sit on my butt and put my hand up, which is still like 6-7 feet. Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah, I believe you.
Still tall.
Yeah.
Still tall.
Yeah. So you had a successful career in that sport as reaching Pan Am Games, meddling at Pan Am Games, or Parapan rather. At what point did you decide to shift gears and get into the shot put?
There's a big time frame in there. So I finished university in 2012. Graduated from basketball or finished basketball in 2011. I didn't actually step into shot put until about 2017. So there's about a 5-year gap there. And that 5-year is probably the most important 5 years, because that's where I started to like understand my self identity. Instead of attaching myself to my sport or something that I did, I attached myself to me as a human being. You know, recognize the importance of being disabled. Something that I think a lot of people could take a lot from is recognizing and understanding your superhero, your gifts and whatnot. And what I mean by that is there's a real importance to recognizing your differences. Because the more you can recognize your difference, the easier it is to feel a sense of belonging. And then it's even easier to fit in because you already see yourselves for your differences. People recognize those differences, therefore creating a sense of fitting in, but already having a sense of belonging. So I was about 25 when I recognized all of that. And then, yeah, it was about 2017 when all of a sudden shot put presented itself, and kind of the rest went from there. So don't get me wrong, I wasn't thinking, oh man, I want to get off the couch and go play shot put. That definitely wasn't a conversation I was having. It was more being at the right place at the right time. Para Athletics was in Kamloops, where I'm based out of. And they're like, hey, would you be interested in trying our sports? And I was like, yeah, sure. I was 30 years old at that time. And so I, you know, stepped into the circle and like, oh, maybe this could be something I could do. Maybe not do well at, but something I could definitely do.
So you're 30 years old before you even start your track and field career.
Correct. Correct. The best way I can describe shot put is when I tell people I'm a shot putter, I say, or follow it up with, you know, that thing we all did in elementary school, that thing, it just took me 20 more years to determine that I wanted to do it again. So yeah, I was 30 years old when I realized that I understand myself. I understand, you know, how I put myself out there. And at the same time, this shot put seems like a lot of fun and I'm really enjoying it.
Were you pretty good at it right away just because of the size?
There's no question that my size helps. And so, yeah, I think it does. But on top of it, because I'm based in Kamloops, this is where Dylan Armstrong is from, the Canadian Olympic thrower, shot putter, the best shot putter in Canada at one point. And he ended up coaching me. And so I had that professionalism. I had that understanding of sport and competition and the sport of shot put right away. And so I think that really helped excel it. But also, I'm 30 years old, right? Like there's a level of maturity to that piece that perhaps, you know, a 15 to 20 year old won't have, because understanding high performance, understanding the work, the time, the energy that goes into perfecting a skill is a little bit more challenging because there's life and work and girls and this and that. And there's so many more distractions. Whereas, you know, I had the university experience, I had the volleyball experience, and I knew how to apply all of them. So I was lucky enough that it all worked at once.
Yeah. And obviously took you to your first Paralympic Games, which was Tokyo 2020/21. What was that like? I guess you'd already done the Pan Am Games, represented Canada internationally on the volleyball side. What was it like as part of Team Canada for the para shot put?
Yeah, so it was my dream to always go to the Paralympics. When I competed for Canada, both seated and standing, we never had the opportunity to go. We just never qualified. And so having those experiences, being like, you know, fighting to get that spot, fighting to try and earn your way onto the team, was an awesome drive. but I never achieved it. So shot put was that sport that finally got me there. And just like all of us experienced, COVID was a nightmare, an incredible thing. There were so many ebbs and flows and so many crazy things going on during that time that, you know, you just never knew what was going to happen. And so the COVID Tokyo Paralympic Games were amazing because they were the first games I ever earned a spot on. And my intent the whole way through my journey was I just want to attend a Paralympic Games. I've never been. Not even, you know, talking about medaling, because, you know, medaling wasn't the goal. The goal is to go to the games and then enjoy the process of the games. Unfortunately, there's nobody in the stands. You know, you're very limited in what you could do in terms of exposure to the village and the city and all that. So you couldn't really do anything. You're wearing your masks 24/7. So we were really, really limited on what we could do. But once I got there, I was like, okay, this is amazing. Let's go and enjoy the competition. And 2 years prior to the games, I'd competed at the World Championships where I placed second. So I had momentum going into it. And, you know, I stepped into that circle, and on my first throw, I ended up throwing a Paralympic record of 16.75 and put the pressure on right away. And nobody caught up. So that was my, you know, first Paralympic experience, but on top of it, my first Paralympic gold medal.
So one and done, just go out, set a record and sit back and watch everybody battle for silver.
Yeah. Like one of the conversations Dylan and I often had was, hey, when you're in a competition, go out there and throw your furthest on the first try, because shot put is a lot like golf. When you really want to hit that ball in golf really, really far, you have to try less. So if you're in a position where you can throw it far enough, where now everyone has to try harder, perfect. It's the mental piece of that game. And that's exactly what we did. Went out there, threw far. People then had to throw even further in order to medal. And it was pretty evident after the first like five throws, because nobody threw over 16. And then on like the last throw, somebody threw 16.29, but I still had four of the furthest throws.
I can totally relate to that as a terrible golfer, because, you know, trying harder doesn't necessarily make your results any better, because you generally get a little bit tighter. You definitely start thinking about the wrong things. And yeah, it puts that different kind of pressure on you. I can totally understand that one.
Yeah. I often compare shot put to golf because it's such a technical sport, you know, and one little adjustment could make a very big impact. But the less you try, the more successful you'll be.
I would not have drawn the comparison between shot put and golf, but when you put it that way, it makes sense.
Yeah. Even in your footing, like when you're driving through it, like you're pushing off from your, you know, you're swinging right, you know, your right foot is in the ground and it's turning and it's creating that momentum through your hips and everything like that. Shot put's the same way.
So after Tokyo, you win your gold. You retired for a little bit, did you not?
I did. Yeah. So I would say that I retired on September 1st of 2021. That was the day I competed. So once I threw and won, I was like, I'm done. And I feel like I stepped away for a couple of reasons, but one of them was I was exhausted by COVID.
Mm-hmm.
COVID really, really tired me out. But on top of it, my program, I was exhausted by the program. It obviously works. There's no question there. But I don't know if it's meant for a 35, 36-year-old, because that's how old I was when I was competing. And I don't know about you, but the older we get, you know, a little bit harder we are on ourselves, you know, a little bit harder it is to get out of bed, all of those kind of things, right? And so the program just beat me up. Like I was pretty done with it. And so, yeah, I chose to step away. COVID tired me out. The program tired me out. And I thought, you know, it's time to kind of start the other chapter of my life. you know, building a family, you know, getting engaged, like all that kind of stuff, buying a house. And so that was the plan, and that's what I ended up executing. So that was all great. And then July of 2023, and things changed from there.
And just decided, maybe I got a little more gas left in the tank, and maybe you just needed a break to kind of reset, step away, and reassess.
100%. I remember watching World Para Athletic Championships in Paris in 2023, and I was like, looking at all my, you know, former teammates and whatnot, just absolutely crushing it. And I'm like, oh man, like, I feel like I could still do that. Like, I miss this. And I miss this, but I'm also like on this place of, am I attaching myself to the being a shot putter again? Or am I just like, I miss it and I enjoy it, and I'm not enjoying all the things I'm doing right now. Perhaps I can do both. And so, yeah, on July 18th, I put into note to Canadian Center of Ethics and Sports and let them know that I was considering coming back. I had to do that because, for people that don't know, a lot of Canadian athletes are on the doping control. We're on these lists where we have to randomly provide times where they can randomly show up to our house. So, sorry, we're not putting out random times. We're giving them specific times where they can randomly show up to drug test us. Most people don't know this, but it's something that we do like on a daily basis. You know, they show up, we have to give them urine samples, blood samples, all of that. If we don't do it, we can get an X, and you get three X's in a calendar year, and you're considered missing, doping, and you could get banned from your sport. So on July 18th, I had to let CCS know that I was thinking of coming back because there's a 6-month window there where I'm not allowed to compete. And I'm instantly put back on their redshirt testing pool. And I was randomly drug tested for 6 months leading up to July 18th or January 18th when I could compete.
Is that 6-month window because you hadn't been tested in the months leading up to that, and they have to get you back in the program and make sure you're clean?
Yeah, exactly. It's more so a reassurance to ensure that the athletes that are coming back are clean. You know, just want to make sure that we aren't doping or doing anything like that, and then jump in and then all of a sudden compete and throw, you know, ridiculous numbers or something like that. It's just to ensure you are a clean athlete.
Once you're back in the system, how often are you actually tested?
When I was back in the system, I got tested like 4 or 5 times in those 6 months.
Okay.
So, and then since then, I think I've probably been tested, I don't know, 3 or 4 times.
Yeah, there's that whole anti-doping thing. That's you could talk for hours just on that. But I think your average fan doesn't necessarily know that, you know, somebody might just knock on your door one day and say, "Well, you pee in a cup because you're on the list, and today's your random sample day," and you have to let them know pretty much full time where you're going to be, you know, within an hour or two, right?
Absolutely. So there's two different programs. There's the NAP, so National Athlete Pool. And that's where you can just randomly show up, and you have to provide a sample. If you don't, they'll follow you around until you do. It's like once they make eyesight with you, they will follow you everywhere you go. So I've had times where it's been like 5-6 hours later by the time I provided a sample because I was training and doing this and doing that. So, but then there's RTP, Registered Testing Pool. And that's where you get put on a program called Whereabouts. And you have to give your whereabouts every single day, 365 days a year. There's no day off, where you will be for 1 hour. And they can show up in that hour randomly to drug test you. And if you're not there and you say you were, you can get an X.
Yeah, I've heard some... interesting stories of people getting knocked on the door or being followed around or not being home because they were stuck in traffic and the sample taker was waiting at their front door when they pulled into the driveway. So it's obviously a very serious issue, and obviously we've seen so many violations of it, especially in recent Olympics, through systematic cheating across the board. So it's nice to know that even Canada does take it seriously, and we do want our athletes to compete clean. So you get yourself back in the program, you do your 6 month of training, but not competing.
Yeah. Your probation.
Yeah. And then, then you dive right back into competition and lead up to the 2024 game. So how hard was it to get your spot back on that team?
I would say it was challenging. I'm never one to put the cart before the horse. So even if I'm, you know, the defending Paralympic champion, you know, that didn't guarantee me a spot. Plus, when I returned with a different point of view. I was not doing the same program anymore. I wasn't working with Dylan. I was working with my current coach, Patrick. Excuse me, shout out to Joint Effort here in Kamloops. But Patrick, you know, and I chose to work together to have more of a view of how can we feel good when we're training versus this is the program to throw far. And so a lot of the focus was how can I move through my body? How can I generate power to help me throw farther but feel good while doing it? Don't get me wrong, there's going to be times where you're training. So there's going to be times where it's super uncomfortable and you're super tired and all that. But it's how can we ensure that there's less injury and there's more movement throughout your body so you can feel good. And so that was our approach. So going into this season with a new coach, a new program, I didn't know where I was going to be for my spot because I only knew the old program and I knew how that worked, where I didn't know how this one was going to operate. So we just kind of, I'm not going to say we kept our heads down because we didn't. There was a huge team effort and support, you know, from Carla, our director, nutritionists, physios, everything. We all really came together and, you know, helped me move through a lot of movement and frustration and pain that got me to the Bell Trials in Montreal and went out there and competed and was, you know, lucky enough to earn that spot again. It also helped that I competed at World Championships in May in Kobe, Japan, where I finished second as well. But I didn't earn my spot there. I only earned a spot for Team Canada. Because that's how like the Paralympics work, is you are earning quota spots, you're not earning your spot. And when team selection comes up, they look at how many quota spots they have available, and then they base the team off rankings, performances, all of that. That then determines who they're going to invite to the games. And yeah, I think I was sixth or seventh on the list of 10.
So you actually had gone to the Worlds, competed on behalf of Canada to earn Canada's spot, but there was no guarantee that was going to be you coming back a year later for the Olympics.
Correct.
Yeah. So you go to Montreal, you win your spot, first place in Canada.
Yeah.
And you keep mentioning you have a very different mindset going into your second Paralympics. You're treating it differently. Explain that.
I think our mind frame, I don't know if I've ever used that term before, our mental health is extremely important. I keep having this conversation. I'm sure we've all heard it, like 60-40, you know, at 60%, or 80-20, 80% showing up, 20% just going out and doing it. I think all those numbers are wrong. I think it's 100%. Because if you think about like what got you to where you are today, people will be like, my legs got me there. I'm like, yes, but you had to tell your legs to move to go there. Right? If you're not 100% committed, you're not going to show up, period. You can be 80% committed, still go, but you're still not 100% committed to what you're doing. And that plays a really, really important role. But what happens in our lives is we can have those commitment. We can, you know, feel like we're really motivated to do stuff. But then we start to introduce things that are like fear-based. Oh, am I good enough to be here? Guilt-based. Oh, did I put in enough work to make this happen? Anger. Oh, I didn't do all the work. I'm here now. I'm frustrated. You know, all of like we're feeling a lot of stuff. But on top of it, we start to experience these things called expectations. Right? And honestly, a lot of times, the expectations aren't coming from the external factor. It's coming from us being like, oh, did I do enough work? Is this good enough? Hey, I'm the Paralympic champion. I have to win again. Right? I have to defend my title. If I don't, I'm a failure. Or if I don't defend this, everyone that helped to support me for this past year are going to feel really sad and feel really bad. Or they're going to be upset with me. We create this dialogue. We create this story that prevents us from doing things. And so, yeah, I talk a lot about mental health because that's the stuff that matters. If you're not 100% committed, you're going to make a mistake. Something's going to happen. And so going into Tokyo, the focus was, this is my first games. I really want to experience this. Going into Paris was, I really want to go and enjoy this. I didn't get that opportunity during the COVID games. I want to experience it with my family, my fiance. I just want to enjoy an actual Paralympic experience. And that was the focus until 2 days before I competed. And those 2 days before I competed were hell. They were brutal. All those expectations came in. I'm a failure. I'm not good enough. You need to defend your title. All of these things that created nonsense pressure. And I was like crumbling. And I'm like, dude, you've been here before. You know this is going to happen. And we've practiced how we're going to get ourselves out of it. But it was so heavy. It was so full. But one of the greatest things that we have available to us, even though it takes a lot of vulnerability to do it, is to ask for help. And that's exactly what, you know, Team Canada has. We have people in place to help those situations. And so I was grateful enough and appreciate Penny Werthner, our sports psych, to help me. And I'm very clear about this. Help me walk off the cliff. Not help me walk back from it. Help me walk off of it. And why I say that is important is because I am feeling that way. So if I prevent myself from feeling it, I'm just going to still be feeling it. But if she helped me walk off of it, it means I am feeling it. I can express it in a safe way. I can move through it and move on. And by moving on to it, I'm not feeling it anymore. Now, there's something very, very important in that, though, is ensuring you have a safe space to do it. But there's an importance to feeling your emotions, learning about them, experiencing them, so that you can move through them. And Penny did a great job. There was multiple times where I was crying. I was feeling frustrated, right? I'd get upset. But I would feel it and then move through it. So then on, Wednesday morning, the 4th, when I competed, I didn't feel a thing. I felt freaking fantastic. That's because I knew I could trust in things. I was in a place of ownership because I asked for help. I trusted in all my actions that got me here, and I aligned with my integrity. And I just allowed the competition to happen. But I as you can tell, I get really adamant about this is because this stuff is very important.
Oh, I totally agree. And I do a lot of coaching, and this is something that I focus on just as much as the physical side. First of all, separating the story from the skill is absolutely critical. Going back to your golf example, like, it doesn't matter if it's the last hole of the Masters or you're out for a practice round on Saturday morning. The skill should be the same. If you're going to go hit a golf ball, it should be the same mechanics, but you tell yourself a different story. You start believing all sorts of different things about why this shot is different. And so there's that side of it. But also I love how much and how passionate you are talking about mental health and just feeling your feelings, like acknowledging them and then giving them the credit. Like you're feeling it for a reason. So you might as well try to work through it as opposed to, like you said, just bottle it up and forget about it. So totally. I totally admire that. Not only that, you know, that you work through it and you're successful at it, but also that you continue to talk about it. And this is where I wanted to go anyway, but into your motivational speaking role where you visit groups or schools or whatever, and you really seem to share that message.
Yeah, absolutely. I had a thought there and I totally lost it. It's going to come back. But when it comes back, I'll... So I love speaking. I love talking. So one thing, again, that I think is important is owning things. Like, really owning your importances, if that is a word. Importances?
It is now.
It is now. You know, or owning authenticity, owning your true self. I am one of those people, like I said in the very beginning, I can be walking down the street and you're going to be staring at me. When I walk into a room, I don't have to say anything to own it. I can walk into a room and just, you can feel it, how much the tone and everything changes when I walk into a room. And I'm not trying to brag and I'm not trying to be conceited or anything. I know that me as my size and the way that I can be vulnerable with myself resonates in the room when I walk in. Vulnerability is the key to growth and success. If you want to see changes in your life, you need to be vulnerable, period. There is no growth in comfort.
I totally agree. And just on that point, sorry to interrupt, but on my list of notes here, I don't know if you can see right there, vulnerable is written down right next to mindfulness, because I've noticed you, first of all, you make yourself vulnerable in sharing the experiences, but you talk about how important it is to accept that and kind of explore that.
Absolutely. So I always give this example. If I was holding something in my, say I was holding an apple and I wanted to give it to you, right? You could take it from me because I own the fact that I own that apple. But if I don't have an apple in my hand and I'm trying to give it to you, you can't receive it. So what are you receiving? You're probably receiving, I don't know, my insecurities, maybe my fears. If you don't own something, it's hard to give it. So if you want to experience love and you want to be able to give it, you have to be love. You have to be in this place of acceptance, surrender, vulnerability, so that you can feel what love feels like. Because majority of us, our society is a very reactive society. And what I mean by that is when somebody says something to you or something is being done to you, we're very quick to answer. We're very defensive. What vulnerability is when that thing is said to you, it's one, not reacting. Two, taking a deep breath. And then three, being like, okay, this is either really uncomfortable. Why is it uncomfortable? And then accepting, surrendering, going back to accepting the emotional piece of it. But if we're not vulnerable, we can't experience that.
Well, and like you said, the comfort zone is a terrible place to spend all your time, because you're only ever going to do the same things. You're never going to expand your horizons. You're never going to get out of your shell. You're never going to improve if you don't make yourself a little bit uncomfortable somehow.
Absolutely. So, and do you know who spends a lot of time in vulnerability?
Who's that?
Athletes.
Oh, yeah.
Athletes spend a lot of time in that vulnerable space, because how do we get better?
You got to do stuff you haven't done.
Yeah, we got to push through things that are challenging. We have to motivate ourselves and move through things that we either can't do or haven't done before. And we need to make mistakes and we need to fail. Failure is so important. And it's one of these things that we are all very shy to talk about. But if you want to create growth, you want to do things, you need to learn that failing is a good thing. Yes, it feels uncomfortable, but it's very important to help you move through that process. And oftentimes when I'm speaking to schools about the importance of failing, all the kids are like, no, I don't fail. That's bad. You know, I don't make mistakes. Yes, you do. And that's great. And we need to motivate you and help you see that those failures are good. But more importantly, those are what are going to help you learn. Those are what are going to help you push through those really challenging times. Those are what's really going to teach you about the importance of being vulnerable and creating self-growth.
I basically, going back to COVID and how uncomfortable that was, I had a habit of, in basically, I lost all the jobs I had. I had all of I work in curling, and curling clubs closed. Curling events were canceled. I also own a business that was closed. And so I ended up spending all my time at home by myself, and I was climbing the walls. The only way I got through that, I took up a new hobby every week, something I hadn't done before. Let's see if I can, you know, take up woodworking for a while. And I'd go down the basement and tool around, and I'm like, hey, maybe I should, you know, play guitar a little bit more or whatever. But like, it's just anything that was challenging me to try something I hadn't done, expand my horizons a little bit. It was a great distraction. And at the same time, I wasn't great at most of them, you know, but I was just out there doing it to keep, again, I didn't want to get comfortable being miserable. And so I found a way to be uncomfortable and a little bit happier.
Yeah. It's such an interesting thing too, on top of it, how uncomfortable silence is. Right? Like when I gave a talk here the other day, I didn't speak for the first minute and a half. And I just watched people squirm. I just watched them like question and like, what's going on here? And honestly, it's one of the things I like to do. I wasn't going to share this, but I'm like, I think it's important. Think about how awkward silence is. And it's not awkward because there's nothing going on. We make it awkward. Yeah.
It is a little bit awkward, right? On a podcast, though, because you always wondered, like, did my phone cut out or it's just a pregnant pause. Uh-oh. There.
Yeah. Uh-oh. What's going on? But no, like, there's so many things that go on in our lives. But if we don't have the tools and understanding to recognize those things, life is hard.
I think giving credit to, like you said, all those uncomfortable emotions and acknowledging them, working through them, finding a way to move forward, even if through that discomfort, I think that's absolutely probably the number one critical lesson of life. That's how you're going to, you know, be successful, if you can manage the emotions, acknowledge them, and work through. We have just a couple more minutes. I want to keep you down, but one other thing we have in common is, first of all, like I said, in my coaching, I share a lot of the same messages that you've been talking about. So I really love that about you. But the other thing we have in common is that we've both written a children's book, and about some emotional journey.
Yeah.
So mine is called Rosie's Toesies, and it's about my dog who broke her toe and had to basically stay positive and patient and go through the recovery process before she could go back to the park and play with her friends.
Yeah.
And you've got one called Stand Out. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So Rosie's Toesies, that's a great name for a book. I appreciate that. I'm going to have to check that out.
Available on Amazon. So I'll send you a copy.
Perfect. Oh, awesome. And I'll do the same. So yeah, my book is called Stand Out. So about a year and a half ago, a publisher by the name of Sean Campbell, incredible guy here in Kamloops, reached out to me, and he's got a series of books. And the first standout that he made was about a gentleman here in Kamloops called named AJ Baines, who was the captain for the Kamloops Blazers many years ago during their like Memorial Cup run days and everything like that. At a young age, AJ was diagnosed with diabetes. And it was just all about how the diabetes affected him and how he overcame the challenges of it and still excelled in sport. The standout for me is a true story about Paralympic gold medalist Greg Stewart. And it's really about learning to understand who you are. The importance of looking at yourself, being vulnerable with yourself, and accepting these things that we cannot change. And so for a lot of time in my younger years, I was in this place of trying to prove to people that I was worthy. I was trying to prove to people my value. But what I didn't recognize is that my value is authentic to me. Having one arm is really important. Being disabled is my superhero. And once I learned that, then amazing things started to happen in my life. And so, yeah, it's a children's book, even though the way I just described it sounds very in-depth, but it's just it's another way for, you know, children and young children, older children and adults to just learn to be true to yourself. learn to recognize how truly incredible you already are, and that you don't need and try to prove to people that you're worthy and that you have value, because it already exists within you. And it's just recognizing that, because once you recognize that, like we said before, we finally feel a sense of belonging, and we're start, and now we're in a place where we fit in.
Very cool. So
yeah, and found on Amazon and whatnot. You can also reach out to me. So my website is www.themindfulete.ca. So the mindful E-T-E. You can reach out there or on Amazon or whatnot. So
yeah. So just the last thing I was, again, on my list, you're doing all the segues for me here, but what is the mindfully, what does that mean to you, or what's the drive behind that project?
The mindfully is the mindful athlete, right? If we aren't mindful of who we are and how we are projecting ourselves on the world, we're going to create a world full of uncertainty and chaos. If we can take a moment to take a step back, take a deep breath, recognize who we are and where we are, we might be able to bring a lot more love, vulnerability, and acceptance to our life, which then creates that in the environment around us.
Very cool. Last question. Do you have anybody, any sponsors or family or anybody you want to thank, anybody you want to give a shout out to, or anything else you need to plug?
I just want to say thank you to all of my supporters to this day, my family, my wife, my coaches, the IST, Team Canada, Blackwell Dairy for all the milk this past year. Oh, man, they have like the best chocolate milk in the world. And that I'm also open to sponsorships. I would love, I am planning to compete for another 4 years, with the importance on adult health and ensuring that, as an older person, you can still achieve high performance.
That's awesome. And one thing I had on my list that we didn't even get to touch on is you got married right after the Paralympics, which is a whole other emotional journey I've heard you talk about.
Yeah.
So congratulations.
Yeah, I won two gold medals. Yeah, I won two gold medals in September, but the real main one was marrying my wife, Taylor.
Well, that seems like a lovely place to put a bow on this one. I want to thank you once again for taking the time to join me. I love talking to you, and I love the message that you're sending. So I really appreciate it, and I hope our paths can cross sometime soon.
Awesome, Brian, and thank you very much for creating this podcast and having an importance of hearing what it's like, what life is like during, after, before. Because I think that's often we see this, perhaps this glory that's created, but we don't recognize the time and effort it takes to get there. And so having someone like yourself to share that, we really appreciate. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I get a kick out of it. It's every time the Olympics rolls around, it's the casual fan just sees a lot of these sports for 2 weeks every 4 years and says, oh, never wondering what did they do for the last 4 years between Paris and now? Absolutely. Trying to shine a little bit of light on that. And once again, thanks for taking the time, and hopefully we can shed a little light your way.
Sounds good. Thank you.
See Thee Rise is a Left Button production. Follow us on Instagram at SeeTheeRisePod or email us at SeeTheeRisePodcast@gmail.com.